Good morning. This is KBBI AM 890 Homer, and you are tuned to the coffee table. The time is 9:03 a.m. And in the studio this morning, John Mink from Lime Solar. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Jim Levine from Jay Brandt and Homer Electric Association's Board of Directors.
And myself. Hi, Kathleen.
And representing your own self. And on the phone is Chris Rose. Chris, do you read me?
I can. Good morning.
Oh, marvelous. So we are all assembled, and the topic this morning is renewable energy in Homer. So the first thing I would like to do is allow you guys to introduce yourselves briefly before we get into it, so everybody knows who we're talking to. And I will be opening up the phones for questions in just a few minutes. But first, Chris Rose, you are the founder of Renewable Energy Alaska Project. Is that correct?
That's right. I've been the executive director since we formed the organization back in 2004. Renewable Energy Alaska Project is a statewide nonprofit education and advocacy group for renewable energy and energy efficiency. We're actually a coalition of more than 80 dues-paying members. Homer Electric Association is one of them, including independent power producers, utilities, both large and small, non-governmental organizations, a variety of energy stakeholders.
Okay, thanks. And John Mink, would you introduce yourself a bit?
Sure. I work with Lime Solar. Our main office is in Anchorage, and I'm the Kenai Peninsula consultant. I'm based here in Homer, lived here for a while, and love the community and here to help it out with renewable energy options.
And can you tell us a little bit about the company, Lime Solar?
Sure. Lime Solar, we do primarily solar at this point. We've been around for over 6 years. We've put in the largest arrays in Alaska. We do anything from portable units up to several hundred kilowatts. And if you know what that is, it's several hundred panels. So anything that's big, we can do. Anything that's small, we've done. We've done it all over the state. You know, if we can get there by boat, by plane, or air drop it in, we can install it and get it done for you.
And you say you put in the largest arrays in Alaska. Where are they?
Well, our largest ones is in Naknek. And that was 110 panels, I believe. And that was for the high school. And some of the other, some of those panels are now being used in other parts of the city now because we produce a little too much power for them.
Oh, that's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
And Jim Levine. Jim, yep. Introduce yourself to the two people listening who don't know who you are.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks. Well, I'm Jim Levine. I've been pretty much involved in renewable energy items, trying to be, since I was in college. I got interested in it while I was in college in the 70s, and which, believe it or not, we've been messing around with renewable energy stuff since the 70s. Seems like it takes an awfully long time to get stuff going, but here we are. We seem to be finally starting to get some traction. Like you said at the beginning, I work for Jay Brandt, General Contractors here in Homer. And I'm on the HEA board. However, today I can't really represent HEA because we're not having a board meeting in this room. So
right.
I can only represent them when we're in a meeting.
And Chris Rose, I wanted to start with you today. We had a conversation yesterday and also one last week about, I would love to talk to you a little bit about industrial-sized power generation, like for whole communities, because I am definitely going to be talking a little bit more later about how you make your own home more energy efficient and use renewables in your home. But can you help explain to me, Chris Rose, about the energy co-ops in Alaska and how they operate?
Sure. Well, of course, there's the Rail Belt grid. That area that we call the Rail Belt is essentially Homer up through the Kenai Peninsula to Anchorage and to Fairbanks, and there are six utilities in that area. And then there are several different companies outside of the Rail Belt that operate a few villages. AVEC is the biggest one, Alaska Village Electric Co-op. They actually operate utilities in 57 villages that are off the road system. Alaska Power and Telephone is another handful. TDX Power is a few more. But besides that, there's over 100 small, remote, what we would call microgrids or islanded grids that we work with to integrate renewables into those small diesel grids. But I think the focus of today is a little bit more on the rail belt. And those six utilities have been around for 70 years or so, and it made a ton of sense, I think, 70 years ago when there was quite a different road system and really no electrical transmission system and nothing like the internet existing for those six utilities to be operating independently. And over time, I think there's been so many improvements with the road system and the transmission system and the cooperation between the utilities and selling power back and forth on a kind of ad hoc contract basis, that there's been a lot of movement toward operating the grid as a whole. When you're talking about large-scale utilities in the rail belt, most of them are operating natural gas, which, you know, from a climate change perspective, relatively speaking, is a good thing, because there's still a lot of coal-fired power in the lower 48. We are in the rail belt roughly 90%, 85% natural gas-fired and a little over 10% hydro. The non-hydro renewables in the rail belt, though, that percentage is really small, and that's one of the things we're working to increase. Natural gas fired power, as I said, is cleaner than coal, but it's still a fossil fuel. And I think more importantly for consumers in the rail belt, it is a volatilely priced fuel. There are two utilities, MLMP and Chugach in Anchorage, who own a part of the Blue Good gas field, and they believe they've got a portion of their gas needed to fire their generators, you know, for another decade or a little bit more. But the other utilities that rely on natural gas, including Homer Electric, don't have any contracts for that gas past about 2023. So we don't know how much the gas is going to cost. And one of the biggest advantages of renewable energy, of course, is there's no fuel price. So if you can eliminate that volatility of fuel price and put in a fixed-priced power like wind, solar, hydro, geothermal, and so on, then you can more accurately predict what the cost of power to consumers is going to be over time. One of the issues, though, we have in the rail belt is that these six utilities typically operate within their own service district. There, like I said, have been some power sharing over the years. In fact, Homer Electric had been a wholesale consumer of power from Chugach for many years, about 25 years. But there's not a central operator for the rail belt grid that can help integrate variable renewable energy electrons, like coming from wind, which would make it a lot easier to integrate renewables if we had a bigger, what they call, balancing area. If all six utilities are operating in their own smaller service district, it's harder to integrate the variable electrons from wind and solar than it would be if the entire region were able to integrate electrons from wherever they're being produced. Good example. There are places around the world, like Denmark and Germany now, that have wind farms spread out all over the country, so that at any given moment during the day now, the Germans and the Danes are pretty confident that a certain percentage of their electricity is going to come from wind, because there's different weather systems in different parts of the country, and they can integrate that wind into that grid and then spread it around to all the consumers in the country. And Alaska is bigger than both of those places, and the rail belt grid is about 600 miles north-south. So we have an opportunity, we believe, to open up a lot more renewable generation in the rail belt if we were to have what we're, you know, loosely calling a system operator, some kind of a central entity that could dispatch electrons back and forth between all the utilities and allow more renewables to be integrated.
Well, I want to bring John Mink and Jim Levine into this. So, Jim, do you have anything to add to that?
Actually, a couple items that crossed my mind. when you're talking to Chris. One is certainly on the utility scale. When you first got started on the conversation, you were mentioning some of the places where you're sort of expanding into utility-sized renewable energy, and I did want to mention one of my heroes is Kodiak Electric. They are...
They're over 90, right?
Well, they're like 99% renewable. Last I talked to them, they were, once a month, they would start up their diesel generators for an hour just so that they could make sure that they were still running. And other than that, between Terror Lake and their six wind turbines, they were 100%, they're 100% renewable most of the time. And I certainly agree with Chris on a lot of the items that he was mentioning, because by doing that, they brought their rates down to what they were about 15 years ago, and they were able to build a brand new office building for themselves, and still have their rates what they were 15 years ago just by using essentially no cost for their energy, for their power.
And in Kodiak, it's not all, when you're coming into Kodiak Harbor, of course, you see the turbines.
Turbines, yeah.
But that's not where most of their energy comes from, is it?
No, most of it comes from Terror Lake. It was part of the, I think Terror Lake was built as part of the, I think they called it the Six Dam Pool or something like that. Four Dam Pool, okay. Yeah, I wasn't around during that time when they were starting on it, but at some point they bought Terror Lake from the state. And so it's part of their system. And the other thing I was going to mention was one of the items that HEA has been involved in and looking at is in the inlet, sort of underwater current. I think it's kind of called hydrokinetics, and they would look at putting some kind of underwater turbine in the inlet. And producing power from that. We have, in the past, worked with a company, Ocean Renewable Power, and they've actually got a unit, I forget the name of the town, but somewhere over across the inlet, they've put in one of their units and produced power for, I don't know, 6 months or a year or something like that. And then they pulled it out, they've tore it apart. It's actually, if you want to see it, you can go down to East End Road. I think it's over by East Road Services or something like that. It's just sitting there in the yard. Apparently, after they did it, they tore it apart. Must not liked what they saw for their components, and they're building the next generation basically before they get started on it again.
Well, have there been any studies about critical habitat areas and using that?
Yeah, they've been studying it a lot. I mean, they started out up in Anchorage, but they decided that the beluga whale, amongst other things, but I think that the beluga whale issue kind of, and the icing up there kind of made them look lower down in the inlet, so they kind of came down to here I guess we weren't really partnering with them, but just using their facilities. But it would be one of those things, on a utility scale, you wouldn't do it just in one spot. You would have, every few miles or something, you would have an array of these units. So that, as Chris said, so as the tide goes up and down the inlet, some of these units would always be operating. So it would be more like base load, which is where the utilities really need to have their power come from. That's kind of the issue with wind and solar, is that it's not always sunny out, it's not always blowing wind, so they have a hard time figuring out how to deal with stuff that's not constant.
And do you guys feel like that's going to be necessary in order to provide large amounts of energy for the rail belt? Or is it going to, because...
Base load, you mean?
Hydropower. Or hydrokinetic.
I mean, there's a whole array of things. I think it sort of needs to be all of the above.
Correct.
Right.
It needs to be a combination of all renewable type energies, anything from, geothermal to solar to wind. It all depends on geography, really, and what's around you.
Yeah.
I mean, some places, wind works great. other places, it's, you know, it's non-existent.
Right, and Chris Rose was talking about that a little earlier as well. You know, the wind may be blowing in one place, but not in, in another. And so, John Mink, you feel like, or it seems everyone feels like, the thing to do is to use every available resource in order to generate enough power. But so then how do we share power up the road with people if this is, if it's only happening, if the wind's blowing in one place and not in another?
Well, there is
that's a Chris Rose question.
Okay, go, Chris.
Well, you know, as was being discussed earlier, we need a system-wide approach, and we need system-wide planning for both generation and transmission going into the future. And this is typical in other states. Other states have what's called integrated resource planning. That allows for utilities to look into the future and figure out how they're going to approach power generation and approach moving that power between communities. That's the transmission system. For the existence of the rail, but the last 70 years, there's been no system-wide approach, really, to the transmission system or the generation system. Like I said before, we have six utilities that have all kind of been operating in their own system. And there's been no one responsible for the whole. There's been no one responsible for connecting those communities with adequate and redundant transmission, because that's what's really going to be able to allow us to put more renewables into the grid, is to be able to move renewable electrons, let's say, from Homer up to Anchorage when the tide is in down there, or the wind is blowing and the Kenai, and vice versa, so that we can be moving electrons when they're happening, if they're variable electrons, because hydro is baseload, geothermal is baseload, hydrokinetics, tidal power could become baseload if you had enough of it, as Jim said, up and down the inlet. But that's pre-commercial technology. It's not quite there. We're probably not going to see tidal power in Cook Inlet for at least a decade, but we want to be ready for it. And that's the whole point of having this long-range planning. Plans can be modified over time. There's no, you know, you don't have to stick to a 10-year plan today. You can look at it again in 3 or 4 years. But integrated resource planning is going to be super important if we're going to displace our heavy reliance on natural gas.
So I'd like to open up the phone lines. The number is 235-7721 or 1-800-979-5224. Because I'm hoping that we hear from some people across the bay who have off-grid needs, and I would love to start picking your brain, John Mink, and talk a little bit about I realize you also deal with businesses, and you were just talking about providing for the school in Naknak, providing energy. But I also want people to feel free to call in and ask their own very specific questions about generating power for their own homes. So that's 235-7721 and 1-800-979-5224. And also, you could, if you don't feel like hanging on the telephone, you can email questions to info@kbbi.org. So, John Mink, back to you. Here in Homer, do you do home visits and assessments, and who do you work with in order to look at someone's property or home or business and figure out what the equation needs to be in terms of how to provide renewable energy?
Well, it's a question about their power consumption first and foremost, and how they're set up on their own properties. So I try to understand, what are they consuming on a daily basis, on a yearly basis? That makes it easy if they're already on grid with HEA. They have this nice little graph in the lower right-hand corner, and it tells me pretty much everything I need to know on one monthly bill, and it makes life easy. And then from there, it's just a matter of looking at, telling them how much they're going to need, tell them the cost, how they can reduce their costs of what they're using, to make systems more feasible. And it doesn't take very long for me to go do a site eval. In fact, a lot of times I just get pictures of places and I say, just give me the southern exposure, what you're looking to do, and I pretty much can go from there.
And so Is there a list of things you tell people in order to, like, is the first thing you do to try to bring down any waste of energy, or?
The first thing I do is ask them why. I ask them, why are they looking to do this? Some of them want it, some of them need it, and some of them simply, you know, we're talking about being on the rail system. You know, realize as Alaskans, many of us are, you know, want to be truly independent and don't want to have utilities on our bills. That's over half my clients right now looking to go off-grid entirely, which means supplementing with batteries for that energy when so they have consistent power throughout the day and the year.
And how has the technology changed even in the last, say, 5 to 10 years?
Well, we're starting to reach points where we're paying the same amount. We're paying for a panel. We're now making, it's about $1 a watt per panel. So a 300-watt panel is $300. Years ago, that was about, 10 years ago, it was $600, $700. So we're starting to see technology and an industry bring those prices down and making these more, making the options of being, having renewable energy more affordable.
And what about your own home? How do you power it?
My place is powered by natural gas because it makes more sense right at the moment. I got a great rate and I use very little. I can put panels up and charge my place out. But the great thing about it, yes, you know, why I put panels up, absolutely. Because to me, it's more of a industry, it's more of a thing of, do you want to rent or own power? And so when you're buying from any utility, you're renting that power and you are subject to their rate increases or decreases. You don't have that control, just like you would be renting an apartment versus if you own a house, yes, you pay up front quite a bit. But that's, you know, in, you know, a topical view, you own that. And the systems we're putting in right now that are grid tie, we get them priced out in the Homer area. If you're on HEA, they're paying out in 8 years.
Well,
including the winter. So that's not just summer. In summer, what we do, we zero it out. We put enough panels, you're zeroed out for the summer.
And Jim?
Cool. Yeah, I just wanted to jump in on a couple of things that you said that was really good. But one of the things you mentioned was why do people want to put it in? And some people just want to put it in. I was always asked the question, why did I've got a wind turbine, or I did. And
oh, that's right. It needs attention.
Yeah, it
right?
needs attention at the moment. But anyway, the question always came up, what's the payback period, what's the time frame, all that kind of stuff, and why did you put it up? And it's like, well, because I wanted to. I mean, why did you buy a snow machine? Because you wanted to. So I think that's as good a reason as a lot of people can, you know, if you want it, then you buy it. That's
it's what, Alaskan
what
as
most
it gets.
People do, yeah. but it's great that if the, you know, the prices are coming down, that's super.
And how about you, Chris? How is your house powered?
Well, I use a lot of wood for heat. And of course, that's important to note is that heating is a bigger cost to most people than electricity, and I think we all tend to focus on power systems and electricity. But I'm on the grid. I live about 3 or 4 miles past Sutton, and I'm on the MEA grid. I am pricing out a solar system for myself right now to do the same thing that John was talking about, which is to have a supplement. Because who knows what's going to happen with our grid prices. As I mentioned before, natural gas prices might be pretty stable right now, but they are becoming more and more of a world commodity, and the Cook Inlet gas market that we're all reliant on is a really small market. The big anchor customers for Cook Inlet gas are gone. That was the Agrium plant and the LNG facility. Over 80% or around 80% of all the Cook Inlet gas ever produced went to those two facilities. So even when you combine Anchorage into the picture, our market is small and vulnerable to price changes. So I think, you know, putting solar on your house, which has no moving parts and a long lifespan, and it makes a lot of sense now that the prices, as John mentioned, come down almost 100% in the last 10 years or so.
And I'm looking at a whole list of residential and commercial initiatives on the REAP website. I want to direct people there, alaskarenewableenergy.org. There are a lot of plans listed here or ways listed here for a person to afford upgrading their home and putting renewables in their home. So are you, when you say you're looking for adding solar, are you using any of the programs that are on your website?
Oh, what I do, I definitely want to take advantage of the investment tax credit. The federal investment tax credit will allow a person who pays taxes, and most of us do, to take 30% of the cost of the system off their taxes. And that's going to, we only have another year and a half or so of that. So in the next 18 months, I want to get my system in. So for instance, a $10,000 system, I get a $3,000 discount on my taxes. That's a significant chunk. And that's the biggest incentive that anybody in Alaska has right now.
It did work really well. I participated in that program myself when I put up the wind turbine, and it was pretty sweet.
Right.
I also wanted to mention, we haven't really touched on yet, but one of the projects that I've been working on in the past at HEA that hasn't come up yet, but this community solar idea where we'd be looking at kind of allowing members to buy into a solar system at HEA. And I was thinking of it in terms of people that want to participate in renewable energy but don't really have either the resources or the location, or they don't want to own their own power plant but they want to participate. This would allow them to join in. Yeah, essentially. Well, no,
it's a surcharge. I've seen other utilities do it as a surcharge. If you want wind power, you pay a little bit extra.
No, this would be a little bit different than that, it wouldn't be it would not be a share. You can't. As we look into it deeper, it's one of these things, the devil's in the details. And so as we look into it deeper, there is certain tax ramifications and stuff. So we would actually be selling a part of a panel. If it comes to fruition, you would actually own a piece of a panel. You could, I suppose, go down and look at it if you wanted to. But you would include your panel would be part of the overall array of panels that would be located wherever it would be, and then and you would have a piece of that. So
I'd just like to pipe in here. As pointed out, the technology is getting so much better and so much cheaper, both with wind and solar. Other technologies like hydrokinetics are coming along. But what's driving a lot of this has been policy. It's been policy at the national level in other countries. Germany is largely responsible for helping get the solar revolution going through their feed-in tariff, which then led countries like China to really start producing a lot of panels to feed that market, and then that just kind of snowballed, and China is now the leading manufacturer of solar panels in the world. In the United States, we don't have a federal policy besides the tax credits that I mentioned, and they're on their way out. Congress has already set a schedule for those to expire, but there are more than 30 states that have mandated a certain percentage of electricity come from renewable energy. And so it's the state policies that's really driving investment by manufacturers and other folks in the supply chain. Hawaii just passed a law that says 100% of all their electricity has to come from renewables by 2045. And that's mirroring
ambitious.
What's going on in some of the European countries. So that is really what's important, is to having the policy that keeps driving this revolution, really, in the way that we get our energy.
Okay, so we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. You're listening to The Coffee Table, and the topic is renewable energy. This is KBBI AM 890 Homer. Guests are John Mink, Jim Levine, and Chris Rose. We'll be back in two. And welcome back to the coffee table. The time is 9:35. This is KBBI AM 890 Homer. On the phone, Chris Rose from the Renewable Energy Alaska Project is here. And in the studio, Jim Levine and John Mink. So while we were listening to the amazing Tangerine Dream coffee table theme, John Mink was talking a little bit in the studio about new technology in wind, in terms of generating wind energy. And can you talk a little bit about that? You said it's just what's coming out in the next week?
Well, it's out right now.
Oh, okay.
But it's being manufactured as we speak. But it's a fairly new technology. It's turning wind sideways, literally. So it's doing, as people recognize, the large, you know, the three propeller wind turbines. They're prevalent throughout everywhere you pretty much see. Of course, there have been concerns with those. Number one, from an engineering perspective, is the mechanical. Those things do turn. You're talking moving parts. They have a tendency to break down quite easily, especially when you're talking around this area, because you have a lot of silt. Because in the air, and that really, called that rock flour, and that really gets in those things. So you really have to keep up with service and maintenance on those. You can't just, I'm going to have wind and has it in my summer cabin and expect to have, you know, powering up batteries or having it as an option for grid tie, because it may not be working at all. Another concern with those is that they can actually overspin. They can spin themselves to death. So you could say, I have all the wind in the world, but next thing you know, you develop a broken wind turbine because of... because you spun all the gears out.
Yes, yeah, so what happened to your turbine, Jim Levine?
Oh, well, actually, ours didn't have any of those problems. Most of them, I think, have a braking system so that when the wind was blowing too hard, it would break. Not break, but it would have a brake that came on and stopped it from spinning. Our system was actually, somehow one of the wires pulled loose in the head, and it shorted out, and so it burnt out one of the windings. So we're still trying to figure out what to do about that.
Well,
so it'd be great to have new technology. I mean, I'm all for it.
Roberta is on the line. Roberta, do you read?
I do.
Well, go ahead, Roberta.
Good morning, everybody. And I first, if I can, I'd like to ask each one a question.
Oh, yes, please.
Okay, so Chris, hi.
Hi, Roberta.
And Juno, I may have missed a little bit. You usually go to Juno. And did you make any inroads of consolidating the electric companies in the state this year?
Well, we definitely talked to legislators about the same issue we mentioned earlier, which is having some kind of a system operator in the rail belt. A lot of that is now resting with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. It was almost exactly 2 years ago today, June 30th, 2015, when the RCA sent a letter to the legislature with findings and recommendations, and two of those findings and recommendations revolved around forming a system operator of some kind for economic dispatch and forming a transmission company. And as you know, the three anchored serving utilities, MLMP, MEA, and Chugach, on February 1st of this year, did sign an agreement to start power pooling among themselves. Our understanding is that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska will be having some more public hearings later in the summer and early fall on this issue. So I think that this issue is very much still in play.
Uh-huh. And is there something we can do as residents?
Well, I think expressing to both the co-op board of directors and management, as well as local legislators, that you want more renewable energy is certainly important, and expressing those same thoughts to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, if people believe that having a larger grid that can incorporate renewables from all over the region is important, then I think that that's the direction that we're headed in.
Okay. Jim, just wondering, or maybe you mentioned this, HEA, what systemic renewables are being discussed at this time?
Systemic?
I don't know. That's the word I came up with. anyhow, you know, the area-wide.
Yeah, okay. Well, like I said, we've discussed quite a bit that hydrokinetic systems out in the inlet. That has kind of been our main focus for several years on a utility-size scale. Also, they've been looking at, and I'm not sure how popular it is, but there's this Grant Lake project that they put together a few years ago, and it's pretty close now to probably being at least I'm not sure if licensed is the right term, but close to being allowed, if people would want it.
Right.
So that's certainly another area. Otherwise, not really a lot in the wind and solar arena. They did, before I ever got on the board, they did look at the possibility of putting in a large wind turbines, perhaps up on Olson Mountain area.
Right.
But apparently it didn't really pencil out for a... The problem that I've had with wind myself, personally, is that there's a lot of days when it's just not windy.
Yeah.
Most people always think that, oh, wow, the wind is always blowing.
Yeah, no.
Just not true. Even where I live up on the top of, very tippy top of Diamond Ridge, it's just, there are a lot of zero days.
Yeah.
And that really ruins your average.
Yeah, Homer isn't in lucky ways and then unlucky ways. And how is the board at this time towards renewables? Do we have a real supportive HEA board?
They would be.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of interest in it. Most of the board members certainly, I mean, you can, it's pretty easy to see.
Yeah.
It's a good idea. It's just
right.
It's just how do you implement it? The devil's always in the details.
Right.
And so how do we get from here to there? And I'm sure someday we will get from here to there. It's just a matter of how do we do it.
Right. And John, do I have the right name?
That's correct.
I'm just curious, how many solar units have been added in our area in the past year or two?
In the Homer area?
Yeah.
Well, if you're going for what we've done, I just started down here in January, so I've put in two so far. But if you take a look around town, you'll see a lot of people who are independently putting up their own systems. They're mm-hmm. buying them from various shops or whatever. A lot of them are just buying them straight from solar panels from Anchorage. And they're installing, I talked to the guys who put in the posts, the Helix posts in town.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite busy. They've put up two or three already this year, specifically for arrays. These are fixed arrays. So and if you take a look, you just see more and more. I can see my neighbor who's putting up his own. Again, this is something you can definitely, if you're handy, it's something you can do yourself. You can build your own cabin, you can build your own house, you can definitely install solar panels.
Okay.
You know, and if something doesn't go right, then you call us to fix it.
Got it. Well, thank you all three for your work on this, because it just keeps getting more and more important for us to figure out some new ways of behaving.
Thanks for calling, Roberta.
You know, the other thing for solar, nobody really mentions on solar, but to me, I think that it's really up and coming in this area, even though what most people say is, oh, well, it's always dark in the wintertime. But it's not actually always dark in the wintertime. And again, when I was talking to a friend of mine who's got solar panel at his house, he, even in this dead of winter, makes like 50 kilowatts an hour in a month.
To ask, yeah.
And I think that's critical. I mean, and obviously in the summertime, I mean, there's as much solar as you could possibly get or want or whatever. And his system actually starts like in March, because the snow on the ground is a great reflector. He gets as much electricity then probably as in June, because he's got reflection off the snow. The temperatures are actually more efficient for a solar panel.
Correct.
It's a great system. He, as I was saying also during the break, I think, was we put our systems in about the same time. They cost about the same amount of money. They're about the same size, capacity equivalent. And he gets twice as much power out of his system, solar system, out of his solar system as we get out of our wind system. So it's way more, I mean, yeah, it's just way more feasible than everybody seems to think.
Right, because the idea that you don't get solar power on an overcast day is a myth.
You get sunburn on a day you're out in the water. If it's cloudy, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
And did I hear you over there, Chris?
Well, I think Jim and John are right. It not only come down to price, but there's no moving parts. So from a homeowner point of view, it seems to be a lot more reasonable to put a solar panel on your house than to try to operate and maintain a wind turbine. And especially if you're hooked up to the grid. If you're off the grid, then your choices are a lot different. But in the spring, we have the best solar insulation, as they call it, because of that reflectivity from the snow. I was above the Arctic Circle last week in a village called Chungnak that has solar panels. And there are a lot of places above the Arctic Circle now that are putting in solar. And even if you don't have production 12 months a year, the prices have come down on solar so much that it doesn't matter that you might not have nearly as much or any production in the dead of winter.
And the fishing, I just want to mention too, is that the fishing industry also is a big power user in the summertime. So you sort of, you know, you just need to figure out how can you get your supply and demand to equal out with each other.
Yeah, a lot of the business I'm talking to, they're only open during the summer. I mean, you got lodges, you have whether they're remote or even grid tie.
And I saw some terrific looking setups that you do for boats as well, and RVs.
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
Well, the other part of our energy picture, I mentioned heat. We're talking mostly about electricity, but transportation. And look at the electric transportation industry now. Most of the big car manufacturers are really gearing up for more electric and hybrid electric cars, which means that in the summer, when we have all this tremendous sunlight, we could be running our cars off of sunlight. And there are people in Homer who are doing that. And especially if you have a hybrid, it allows you to kick in with the gas engine in the winter. It really is a no-brainer to start saving on fuel. And you know, the problem is that people typically act in crisis. And so when oil prices do go up again, people will all be saying, hey, we should have done this. We should be doing renewables. This is the best time right now when oil prices are low to start getting prepared for when they're obviously going to be going back up.
And that federal tax credit.
Yeah, the tax credit's going away.
How much longer? Did you say a year and a half?
I believe 2019, January 1st, 2019, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it starts phasing out.
Yeah, so it does decrease a little bit and then goes away completely.
And actually, so in going back to your point on the vehicles, one of the thing that I just saw was sent to me the other day was a sharing system for electric charging stations. In other words, if apparently it's going on in Germany, so that's something else you also mentioned, Chris. But in Germany, apparently they've got a system where if you own a charging charging station at your house or your business or wherever, and you can rent it out to other people that need to have a charging station. Apparently, there's just a group of people. I think it's called Share and Ride or something. It's sort of like the bike sharing program in Portland, only it's for your charging stations for your electric vehicles. So it's a really interesting idea. I mean, as technologies move along, people come up with innovative ideas for how to do things.
I think one thing we need to just quickly discuss too is that, you know, we all talk about how we gather the energy, but storage is the key component here, especially here for the winter months. I mean, it's the, you know, we got the peanut butter with the wind and the solar, but how do you keep that? And it's the jelly, and that's your batteries. When you're considering batteries, you got to consider how you live, how you use your property, and how much you really need to store. Like liquid lead acid batteries that you typically see, that most of you are familiar with your car, are, you know, it's distilled water. You have to maintain them. You have to keep them ventilated. So there's certain concerns you have to do with that. But they can last a long time. So when you're considering any type of renewable system is really, and you want to be off-grid or just want a backup other than a diesel generator, that's something to consider. The other type of battery out there right now that I can mention is a gel type, absorbed glass mat. A little bit more expensive, but they can go down to negative 480. You can put them in your house. There's no problem.
Well, that was
leakage.
My next question is, where do you store them?
You can store them anywhere, which makes it really nice. You don't have to keep them warm, but you can. And then you have, but they don't last as long, but you have no maintenance either. So it's really about choice. And then you have, I know people have asked me about this Powerwall from the Tesla and this, those are lithium ions. Same thing they use for their vehicles, which is great, except for it doesn't work past -4. So they are pretty. But you're not as efficient.
It doesn't work past -4?
Correct.
What does that mean?
-4 degrees.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. I'm expecting.
And that's Fahrenheit, not Celsius.
Okay.
So, when you're talking batteries, there's a lot of consideration into about, again, just like wind, where are you at? And now it's like, what's your use? How do you plan to keep that power? And, how do you plan to use that?
Right.
But there's some new battery technologies, just like everything else in this industry, that are going to, in 10 years, it's really going to be phenomenal that, now we're talking about renewable energy and how it's coming to town. In 10 years, I could see a quarter of the town on it in some capacity, either through HEA and or they're on their own systems.
Mm-hmm. And all those innovations are in part driven by demand, and demand is driven either by policy or just people wanting to do it for their own reason. Yesterday, the Conference of Mayors adopted a resolution to all strive for 100% renewable electricity. Now that's not like a mandate like I talked about in other states, but that's the kind of demand that will keep driving investment in these technologies. A lot of people are looking at lithium ion simply because that's what the auto industry is looking at. And there are a few villages right now in Alaska who are using wind in combination with lithium ion batteries and even solar. And they can store those lithium ion batteries inside a utility scale installation. And there are a couple of villages that have been successful enough to just turn their diesel engines off for a couple days at a time. And there are a lot of innovative ways to use storage. That's right, because some of these villages, like Shungnak, where I was last week, they're flying fuel in. They can't even barge fuel in there because the Kobuk River is so low now. So it's untenable for many of these communities around the state to continue to rely on diesel.
And John, you were talking earlier about having a solar panel or having solar energy installed for Naknak School, and that they were generating more than they need. Is it the law here in Homer or in Alaska that if you're generating more power than you need, that the local cooperative buys it from you?
It depends on the utility.
Okay.
HEA does have a program in place for a credit. I'm not going to go into the specifics of it, but it's definitely, I can tell you, it's not one-to-one. I don't think they could have, it's meant as a, hey, it's nice to have, but it's not, I think HEA would say it wasn't meant to be an income generator for their consumers.
Right.
Yeah, Kathleen, yep. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska issued a ruling a few years ago that we do have administrative net metering with the larger utilities, and they do have to buy it back up to, I think, 1.5% of their native load. So once 1.5% of Homer Electric Association's load is in that program, they don't have to do it anymore, but they're nowhere close to that. But as John pointed out, it's not a retail one-to-one net metering. It's the avoided cost of the utility. It's the cost of the utility avoids by not having to generate that unit electricity that they purchase back from the consumer.
Yeah, you don't. It is a net metering program. It's not an HEA program. It's a statewide program, and it's really valuable for you as long as you don't make more electricity than you need on a home scale basis. Because it is one-to-one as long as you don't make extra. When you tip over that point, then yeah, they sell it to you at wholesale cost. So the price is pretty low. I don't remember what exactly it is, but it's much lower than what you pay, because you're not paying for all the utility workers that come along with the utility. So it's really only valuable if you're going to be just kind of replacing your own usage.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house, don't go put up 100 panels thinking, oh, I'm going to make all this money, and be
right.
able to be evened out for the year. It's not feasible. Jim's right. Just like I said, that's what we zeroed out. We zeroed out for summer when we install panels, and that's what we gear them for. And again, we try to make people realistic about what renewable energy is and what you can expect as consumption.
Yeah, our system was about 20% of our of our home usage was getting net metered, so we were saving basically on 20% of our bill.
Okay. I was going to be calling now for last words. Chris Rose, thank you so much for staying on the line for the whole hour. I really appreciate you being a part of the discussion today. And anyone who wants to access the programs, the information, can go to alaskarenewableenergy.org. And Chris, is there any final words from you?
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on. And I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't mention energy efficiency, because it's really fun to talk about generating power with renewable energy. But the fact is that most of us are wasting energy, whether it's through inefficient appliances, inefficient lighting, inefficient heating systems, lack of insulation, cracks in your windows, things like that. These are all low-hanging fruit that everybody should be considering before they are considering generating power with renewables. And there's tons of great information both on our website, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Cold Climate Housing Research Center, Alaska Center for Energy and Power. There's a lot of great organizations here in the state that are working to make our energy systems more efficient first. We believe that we could probably, as a collective citizenry, save about 20% of the $5 billion that we're all paying annually for energy here. That's transportation, heating, and electricity. So we could keep $1 billion in our economy through energy efficiency in those areas and probably create thousands of jobs at the same time.
And Jim Levine, so is there a way to access an energy audit from HEA? Like to find out your efficiency rating?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I guess I could look into that, but I've not heard of one.
Okay, and Chris, thanks so much for being here. Jim, I want to go to you next and say, and is there anything you feel like has been unsaid or any closing statement?
Well, I guess the one thing I'd like to say, well, one would be obviously thanks for putting on this show. This is great to at least be discussing renewable energy in Homer. And yeah, when I first got on the HEA board years and years ago, the big subject at the time was coal and how we were going to be getting coal production down here. And now and since that time, since like my first meeting, we hardly ever discussed coal ever again. But now we have a renewable energy committee at HEA. One of our board committees is a renewable energy committee. So we discuss it all the time. We're really working at trying to figure out how to get that into the mix.
Thanks. And John Mink, your site is limesolar.com. Also, there's an office here in Homer, is there?
Yes, it's my home office right now. I'm looking at retail spaces as we speak.
Oh, great. And is there any thoughts that you'd like to leave us with today?
It's time, folks. The technology has reached a point where it's not just something that's nice to have. It's something that actually works on paper, too. If you like being on grid tie, that's great. You just want to have panels on your house or renewable energy just to tell your friends you got it. That's awesome. But it also works for Alaskans who choose to be off-grid and don't, you know, it's all about the Alaska spirit right now. And it's not just a nice to have. It can work on paper. These are affordable. And I encourage everyone to start doing their research. And if you have any questions, just go to limesolar.com and reach me, and I'll help out.
Well, thanks so much, Jim Levine, John Mink, and Chris Rose. I'm Kathleen Gustafson. This has been The Coffee Table on KBBI AM 890 Homer.
Is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.